The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. By now, you have undoubtedly heard of deepfakes. Deepfakes are audio or visual recordings of a person in which their face or body has been digitally altered so that they appear to be someone else. The idea of manipulating content to have it appear as something else is nothing new. For example, photo manipulation dates back to some of the earliest photographs captured on glass and tin plates during the 19th century. But digital manipulation has taken on new meaning and deeper impact with the advancement of technical tools which lower the cost and effort barrier. The term deepfake was first coined by a Reddit user who created a forum of the same name on November 2nd, 2017. The forum was dedicated to the creation and use of deep learning software for digitally swapping the faces of female celebrities into pornographic videos. Since then, deepfakes have been used in fairly innocuous cases, such as substituting an AI-created image for the deceased actor Carrie Fisher in the Rise of the Skywalker movie, as well as more nefarious uses, such as manipulating the faces and voices of public figures to malign their reputation or manipulate public perception. According to a 2019 study by DeepTrace Labs, an Amsterdam-based cybersecurity company, women were the subject of virtually all of the deepfake pornography videos found by the researchers. And particularly worrisome is that 96% of the videos were identified as non-consensual pornography. However, the deepfakes that leave the greatest impression are the ones targeting public or political figures. In short, deepfakes have become so pervasive and so effective in misleading perceptions that our ability to distinguish reality from the synthetic is more and more in question. There are efforts underway to detect and regulate deepfakes. In February of 2020, Twitter announced the official version of its deepfake and manipulated media policy, which largely involves labeling tweets and warning users of manipulated, deceptively altered, or fabricated media. Facebook and Google have released large data sets of known deepfakes in an effort to spur development of better detection technology. However, exactly what to do and how to regulate them is still a dilemma.
Our guest today is Andrew J. Grotto. Andrew is the William J. Perry International Security Fellow at Stanford University and the founding director of the Program on Geopolitics, Technology, and Governance at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. He serves as the faculty lead for the Cyber Policy and Security Specialization in Stanford's Ford Dorsey Master's in International Policy degree program, and teaches the core cyber policy course for the specialization. He is also a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. He served as a senior director for the cyber policy on the National Security Council during the Obama and Trump administrations from late 2015 through May of 2017. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, you, along with a multidisciplinary team of professors and researchers from Stanford and University of Toronto, among others, published a paper called How Relevant is the Turing Test in the Age of Sophist Bots? So what are sophist bots?
So a sophist bot is an AI entity that is given the task of trying to persuade people of something specified by the sophist bot's master or creator. It could be, to buy a product. It could be to adopt a certain view of a political figure. Could be anything. The sophist bot has no conscience. It may have biases. It may have, opinions, as it were. But it is willing to do virtually anything, that it can do to achieve whatever persuasive objective its author gives it.
Eek. So what would you say are the key points or recommendations in your paper?
Well, we make a few points in the paper. One is that while it's obviously important and all too often overlooked that new technologies can cause all sorts of societal harms, there are legitimate beneficial applications of this technology. You mentioned the Carrie Fisher example from Star Wars. That's one. But there are a lot of other use cases out there. For example, in the retail, on the clothing retail industry, allowing customers to virtually try on clothes, things like that. So there are beneficial applications, and we want to make sure that readers don't and listeners don't walk away from this conversation with the conclusion that the technology is just an unmitigated bad thing. That's not the case. But as new technologies will often do, there are all sorts of challenges that that they can create. And Alexa laid out several of them at the top. The non-consensual pornography, cyberbullying is another one, as well as manipulating public opinion. Those are all harms that we've already seen. One can only imagine if you put your evil genius hat on, all the other nefarious applications of this technology. And so that's the second point. The third point is that there's no silver bullet in technology to manage the risks that this technology creates. We can go into that in some detail, but I'll move on to the last main point. We can return to any of the earlier points. The last point of the paper is that really, that given that there's no silver bullet in technology, what's really going to have to be deployed are a series of policy, ethical, and other non-technical measures to mitigate the risk. These could take a number of different forms depending on the context, ranging from new legal liability regimes to requirements for labeling and provenance, to even softer forms of governance, like norms of behavior in politics, all of which I think have to be part of the answer if we're to appropriately manage the downside risk of this technology.
You mentioned the norms. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in your paper are that politicians, for example, could agree that they are not going to use deepfakes in the service of themselves, for example, creating a deepfake of their opponent to make them look bad. But isn't there a way to get around that? In other words, isn't there a way that you could say, have plausible deniability to say, look, I wasn't the one doing it. It was some of my followers who are far too enthusiastic.
Yeah, that's certainly a risk and would almost certainly happen. I think, norms are at best speed bumps. I mean, a norm is not going to prevent anyone from doing anything if they're determined to do it. But they're speed bumps. And, just in the same way that, you wouldn't rely solely on a speed bump to manage traffic, right? You have other interventions, stop signs, stoplights, speed limits, all sorts of other things. Norms alone aren't a silver bullet either. But, if we live in a world where it is acceptable for, leading public figures, politicians, to malign their opponents, malign those who disagree with them in such a deceitful way, then it's hard to imagine any of the other mitigation measures, having much effect, right? If members of Congress, for example, are freely using deepfakes to malign their opponents, what message does that send to young people who might be tempted to use the technology to bully, right? If their member of Congress is doing it, who's going to tell platforms to invest more resources in managing the risk if Senator so-and-so, right, is using the technology freely in a campaign? And so,
are you proposing civility?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of civility, but I'm also not naive. And so, I've had this conversation on Capitol Hill, actually. And, the first answer I get, the first response is norms. Like, where have you been recently, right? Have you been living in a cave? And I always say, well, look, I mean, first off, the tone of our politics always varied over decades. Mm. You know, there are times when it's ugly, like today, but there are times when it's not. And you know, we shouldn't allow ourselves to, you know, fall in a trap of, you know, of lowering our expectations of what we think politicians ought to be doing. You know, it wasn't that long ago, 12 years ago now, when, you know, there was this controversy around then candidate Barack Obama, this is in 2008, over the pastor at his church, Reverend Wright.
I remember that.
And, you know, John McCain, his opponent in the election, decided not to use that against him. He made a normative decision, right? That was two full cycles ago. So, you know, yes, of course we are in a particularly fraught moment. We should not lower our expectations. In fact, we should elevate them. The more, a more pragmatic argument that plays to more immediate self-interest for politicians is an argument that's sort of like a mutually assured destruction argument. Mm. Where, you know, I sort of put it back and say, do you really want to campaign and govern in a world where it's okay for your opponents and your political enemies to picture you, your family, you know, the people you care about, you know, in this manner? No, you know, and so there is, I think, a possible mad logic there. Now, you know, I spent part of my career working on nuclear weapons issues, and you know, mad is not the most satisfying. It's still fraught, it's dangerous, right? Mistakes happen, yeah. But the point is that we should not lower expectations, nor should we assume that self-interest might not actually result in support for norms along the lines of what we've talked about.
I'm sort of wondering about sort of even the larger question about how much should we accept the existence of deepfakes? I mean, obviously we have to. They're real. They're here. Couldn't imagine the Star Wars movie without them. But I mean, I'm thinking that there are enough people on this planet who had trouble believing that the moon landing wasn't a deepfake. That, you know, how do we sort of step from norms and agreeing not to misrepresent people in defamatory ways, and at the same time have this expectation that, you know, we can provide fake visual video evidence? I mean, it seems like it's a huge mountain to climb.
Yeah, it is a huge mountain to climb, and I think whenever we come across an obstacle like that, there's that old saying, you know, take it step by step, you know, put one foot in front of the other. Another way to put it is, you know, taking a big problem like this, and then trying to really break it down into smaller pieces, where you can then begin to imagine interventions, you know, policy, regulatory, normative, you know, whatever, tailored to that particular slice of the overall problem. Individually, and this is the point we make in the paper. Individually, you know, those smaller interventions, might have a small impact. But when you aggregate them all, it could have a real significant impact, right? So, and in the case of deepfakes, one way to try to break down the problem is to think about, okay, who are the different actors who at some point along the way from, you know, generating from having the technology to generate a deep fake to its distribution, that, you know, that whose behavior can impact or affect the amount of harm that the technology causes, right? And if you break down the problem that way, you start to see there are lots of different actors, mm-hmm. all of whom have a set of responsibilities, whose behavior can be shaped to varying degrees. Beyond the platforms, by the way, you know, platforms get most of the attention, and, you know, we can and should hold platforms, you know, Facebook, Twitter, you know, YouTube, Google, to a high standard, but they're not the only actors with responsibilities, right? Whether it's the authors of deepfakes, those who would distribute deepfakes, the engineers who are behind the technology. They all, each of these actors has a set of responsibilities that collectively, if deployed responsibly, I think would make a real impact in mitigating the downside risks.
So because you brought up platforms, I'm going to jump back to it again, because the whole issue of Section 230 has been in the news. What we're going to do about Section 230, the current administration wants to remove any of the protections that are given these social media companies. Some of them, as we mentioned earlier, like Twitter, has already instituted policies that at least say, look, this is a deep fake or this is misinformation. What do you think should be done? And also, if you could just, for our audience, just give a quick recap of Section 230.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, Section 230 is a provision of law from the late 90s, a bill called the Communications Decency Act, that essentially categorizes online platforms like Facebook, for example, though Facebook didn't exist at the time, as more or less passive conduits of content and not publishers themselves. What that categorization does is in theory at least, let the platform off the hook for what is published on its platform. A prototypical case might be if someone posts something defamatory, the platform is not responsible. The author of that defamatory material is, as a matter of legal liability, right? We're talking ultimately who can get sued, right? What has happened over the years as Facebook, Twitter, social media more broadly has become ever more, prominent in our social lives is a set of higher expectations on the part of the public and policymakers. It's like that saying, I think, from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. That's kind of the sentiment that's starting to kind of chip away at this idea that the platforms are simply neutral, passive conduits through which information flows. And where you see tension emerging now is, there is sort of a political overlay to disinformation, misinformation, and other forms of propaganda. Conservatives have accused the social media platforms of using a heavier hand in moderating content posted by conservatives compared to other groups. The data is sketchy on that, yeah. But that is a strong belief held by many conservative and Republican politicians. And their attitude is like, look, if Facebook, just to pick on Facebook a little bit, is intervening to, discriminate against content posted by conservatives, that's a lot more like publishing. Why should they receive protections under Section 230? I don't want to leave, listeners with misimpression that Section 230 is only a partisan issue. There are lots of people on the left too who have concerns over Section 230 and want to see it reformed. Yeah. As the case is often with issues like this, there's a bipartisan consensus that change is needed, but there's still not a consensus yet on what that change might look like, and that will be something I'm sure that occupies a lot of bandwidth in the next Congress under a Biden administration.
So I'd like to jump back to the notion of Sophisbots. You can tell I'd only ever read it before. And I think that with the discussion so far, it's been pretty easy to visualize these in terms of, the Carrie Fisher in the Star Wars movie, in terms of potentially, malicious campaign videos and whatnot. But I don't want to leave people with the feeling that they've never had the opportunity to, to engage with these bots. Tell us a bit more about some of the different ways that these Sophisbots may actually appear and you know, be trying to influence people?
Yeah, well, so there's a great example that many people already use, or at least are exposed to, and that is the autocomplete functions in email, in Gmail, for example. I wouldn't call that a SofaSpot because that technology is not, you know, we used SofaSpot to describe an entity that's out there to persuade.
Right.
Whereas, you know, but the technology is very similar. I mean, the underlying, you know, nuts and bolts have a lot in common. And that's technology that people, you know, come into contact with all the time. Many people use it. Some people don't. And, you know, it too, frankly, you know, is, again, lots of benefits, but, you know, there are real costs and risks associated with it. And I'll share one that actually raised some really hard ethical questions. One example is, you know, most of the speech that is on the internet, you know, where, you know, these capabilities, that's the training data that's used to train these capabilities. So then, you know, so these capabilities end up sounding like they're training data. Well, if most of the training data is white men, you know, then the bot is going to talk like a white mm-hmm. man. So if we can kind of interrogate that a little bit, you know, on the one hand, so imagine a woman of color who is communicating over email about a potential job. On the one hand, the idea that this capability would sort of channel communications into a particular mode of speaking is problematic. On the other hand, from her perspective, sounding like a white man may be a benefit, right? Because of institutional racism. So there's some hard ethical issues here, and you know, that I think we've only barely begun to surface and think through. But again, that's technology that, you know, people, if you use Gmail, you know, or Outlook, you know, you've got this running. It's there.
You use a really interesting recommendation in your paper about defamation. So you say that, you suggest that defamation laws be changed if, for example, I am being presented in a deep fake in a way that is defamatory to me. And apparently, currently, that is not a recourse. Can you talk a little bit about what is a current recourse for me? I'm not a public figure. I'm not a celebrity. If right now my image were to be used as a deep fake, and what about a celebrity or a public figure? And what do you suggest? How do you suggest that be changed?
Yeah. So the phrase public figure has a particular meaning in U.S. constitutional law in the context of the First Amendment and someone's ability to bring a defamation case. The gist of the Supreme Court decision, New York Times v. Sullivan, that created this public figure concept, is that if you are a public figure and you are trying to sue someone for allegedly defaming you, you have to clear a much higher bar, which as a practical matter has meant that defamation cases involving public figures are virtually impossible to win. And that's grounded in the First Amendment. So short of a constitutional amendment, you know, not a ton of room for fundamental change there. Mm. When it comes to non-public figures, you know, ordinary people like us, defamation is an option. You know, and I think what is what we suggest is, you know, potentially broadening the actors who might be held accountable for an act of defamation. So for example, you know, if I'm defamed using a deep fake and I can prove that the defendant, the person who allegedly defamed me, used a particular piece of software to develop the malicious deepfake, maybe I should be able to sue the software developer. Mm. Unless the software developer has included in their software suite a way to essentially cryptographically stamp or sign a video so that it can be properly identified as synthetic. It's one example. Mm-hmm. Platforms, many of them, already have. So Twitter's guidance is particularly explicit, but I think if you, read Facebook's and Google's YouTube, there's prohibitions on depicting people without their consent already. Fraud and defamation are already, not allowed. So a citizen can go to the platform as recourse. I think
deep fakes are exploding, though. I mean, there's 100,000 deep fakes that Facebook just made available in June. So it doesn't sound like some of these guardrails are working, right?
If the standard is perfection, then no. But that's not, for all the reasons we talk about in the paper. There's no technical silver bullet. The policy options, there's no silver bullet in policy either. We're talking about sort of a collective set of technological and policy interventions to manage risk, not eliminate it. Mm-hmm. I think that in many cases the harder problems have to do with platforms that I've been critical of Facebook, but compared to many other platforms out there, Facebook is, an altar, choir boy, right? Saint. I think it was Tom Friedman, New York Times, has had, I'm gonna have to remember, I think it was Tom Friedman, has this amazing set of articles in the New York Times on the adult pornography site Pornhub, and how pervasive, cyber bullying, porn shaming, videos are on that site, and that's just one of many platforms that don't have the ethical, compass that even Facebook has. In many cases, they may not have the resources and technical sophistication that some of the bigger platforms have to detect deepfakes at scale.
Or the economic motivation. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, right. No, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that at some point, a difference in number, this is following up Alexa's point about just how deepfakes have exploded, a difference in number becomes a difference in kind, right? And so no, we're not looking for perfection as in eradicate all deepfakes, but it seems that we can at least postulate that having more awareness of the fact that, there are synthetic contributions on platforms or in the wild, it seems to me that can undermine if you have some consequences in terms of, like I said before, significant number of people don't believe that we actually landed on the moon. Does it undermine trust in your fellow human? Are there potential consequences of it's not possible? How do you sign something to say, this really is the World Health Organization, and we really are telling you to do X, Y, or Z? How do you then promote truth in a world full of deep fakes?
Well, I think, coming back to political leaders and this question of norms, I think it's got to start there. We're facing, an unprecedented drop in Americans' confidence in our institutions, whether it's the Congress, whether it's the credible fact-based news media. With that comes, I think, a breakdown in the marketplace for truth and ideas. Mm. It allows you know, where in a healthy, you know, political ecosystem, truth would ultimately prevail. And so to take, you know, the moon landing deniers, you know, it's a fringe view. You know, most people believe it. They're proud of it. They think it's really cool, and they want us to go to Mars, right? But that's a fringe view, and it's a fringe view because of, you know, all these sort of other institutions that accept that fact as fact. The era we find ourselves in now is, you know, those gatekeepers, those, you know, market monitors, right, have experienced a real decline in people's confidence in them. And the result is, you know, call it a market, in sort of the free marketplace of ideas, we're experiencing a bit of a market failure right now. You know, the antidotes, again, you know, there is no silver bullet, but, you know, part of it is normative. Part of it, I think, is helping people reconnect with credible fact-based news media, supporting credible fact-based news media. And, you know, for all of the attacks that Trump has levied on the news media, in a lot of ways, it's been kind of a golden age of news coverage. You look particularly among the majors, right? I mean, mm-hmm. smaller papers have been devastated. And that has to be, addressing that has to be part of the long-term answer. You know, so, and among the major newspapers, I mean, there are norms too. I use the example of when, you know, the Ukraine whistleblower, right, that led to the impeachment proceedings. His name was never mentioned by the mainstream newspapers.
Right.
And it's not like they got together in a conference call and decided that. It was, they all came to the same independent professional normative judgment about the appropriateness of publishing that individual's name. Other outlets, you know, less scrupulous, less respectable, did not. They put his name out there. That to me is a sign that, you know, norms still matter. They can matter, and which gets to the question of how do we bolster credible fact-based news media so that when, you know, there's a deep fake out there on this or that, you know, candidate, at a minimum, news media doesn't pick it up and amplify it either inadvertently or not, but also can help, you know, help people, help citizens make sense of the world and get to ground truth.
So speaking about this, speaking about the citizens, you know, norms on one side amongst, let's say, the news media, or let's say politicians, what do you say to people who say, well, really the solution is for the average user to be better educated, informed, because all of these regulatory things, all of the technical solutions, like you said, aren't the silver bullet. The silver bullet is for the average user to be a lot more educated on how to discern the synthetic from the real.
So, you know, as an educator, I'm always pro education, more education. But, you know, we also need to be cognizant of the fact that we are all human. And humans, even very well-educated humans, are still human. We have biases, cognitive biases that study after study has shown are just part of what makes us tick.
Right.
You know, recency bias, right? Confirmation bias. Tribal bias, right? We tend to believe things from people we know or who look like us. You know, all things equal. And you know, education can, you know, in some cases can help, but, you know, this is a human problem. And I think, you know, maybe, you know, people who kind of come up, grow up in this era will be a little more, will be perhaps a little more, let's say less naive is maybe the way to put it. there are limits. And I think, you know, the policy challenge is, on the one hand, we don't want to start just censoring. That's not the American way. You know, no one wants, you know, a heavy-handed sort of state intervention in what people see, because, you know, I mean, for a variety of reasons, not least of which it would be unconstitutional. But there is still a lot more that platforms could do. There's, you know, room for the credible fact-based news to revitalize and restore its role in American society. Now, of course, the big question is how, right? I keep coming back to this idea of taking a big problem, breaking it down into smaller pieces. And there is no silver bullet, but I do think that taking a problem like this and trying to slice it up could yield some real fruit. And so take local media as an example. I would love to see, someone with lots of wealth go out and, for example, purchase or subsidize, local news media, right? Grants for journalists, other forms of support, no strings attached. I would love to see, make it possible for people, in cities across the country, particularly smaller cities, get free subscriptions to their local newspaper. Mm-hmm. Someone's got to pay for it, right? I mean, the newspapers are businesses, but those are all things that really aren't that expensive in the grand scheme of things, but would have a big impact.
So when you're originally describing the deep fakes, I was thinking that the summary might be that just because you can doesn't mean you should, which is always good advice. But it's striking me that, you know, from the consumer point of view, that maybe the good advice that we want to keep to heart is, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. In other words, you know, we have to be more discerning and thoughtful in all the things we engage with.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I would also add that we should continue to hold platforms, politicians, the technology community to a really high standard in terms of being thoughtful and proactive about managing these risks.
Agreed. Well, it's been fascinating. Fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. I enjoyed it.
This was fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.